Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, December 16th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Sustainable Agriculture, a forum led by Dan Gunther, Margaret Pennings, and Grant Gibbs. Session number is GUD-2003-01. Let's listen in.
Maybe should we just kind of sit up here, or what do you think? Margaret, would you just sit up here?
I'll sit here.
Okay.
I can go.
Yeah. I was reminded of, here he comes. You ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, good. I was reminded of another Holden friend of ours, Steve Kramer, who some of you may know, who's farming in Texas, and he said the only thing that farmers like more than farming is talking about farming. Standing around talking about farming, that's always more enjoyable. But I was thinking that in the first few sessions that Margaret and I have done, that we've shied away from talking about specific farming practices. And so we really had hoped that this would be as much of a conversation about farming as possible. We all three of us, as you know, are pretty passionate about farming and other issues, so we're kind of prone to tangents, I think, which is always the risk. And what we decided to do here, just to help us focus a little bit, is go through a brief exercise. Well, not brief, it can kind of take us however long we want it to. I'm trying to solve some huge issues here.
It's up to you.
Yeah. But we want it to be as much of a conversation as possible. We didn't come to lecture, but we kind of put some things together here as sort of a conversation starter. And I went through an exercise. The first time I went through this exercise was with a group of graduate students at the University of Minnesota, and a professor had invited some farmers to come and be part of a graduate class and to react to their papers and interact with them. And he started by posing three questions to the class. One was, how does the world currently work? Well, I've inserted agriculture instead of the world. We were talking about larger issues. And then, that's question A, and then question B is, how should the world work? Okay, what's our vision for the world? And I've changed that to more sustainable ways for agriculture to work. I got a question mark there. It's not really a question we're posing. And then the third piece is really the most important piece, and it goes in between these two. And that is, what is your role as an eater in helping us get from A to B? All right, so nobody's left out. It's not a spectator event. We're all eaters. We're all participants in the agriculture that we currently have and hopefully can contribute to the vision of the agriculture that we hope to have. And so the question is, how do we get from here to there? All of us personally and then the larger culture, agriculture that we have created in this country. Shall we?
Well, and we do have some answers over there, but you can't see them. Because you have to see.
We have some assignments for all of you.
Oh.
Yeah, when you leave. What would be the best way to divide these up? How do you want to walk through this list? Do you want to each take one and kind of bounce around?
Why don't you take one, and then I'll take one,
and then Margaret
to take one? Or
okay. We'll go through this list, then we'll hop across to that list. We'll talk also a little bit about our own farms, hopefully in this process, and how we make decisions on our land, which is a very dynamic and complex part of farming, certainly. And then we want it to be as much of a dialogue as possible, so we thought we'd do this just as a way to guide us a little bit, but if somebody wants to go off on a tangent and skip a few, let's do it, because we want this to be fruitful for you as well. So the agriculture that we currently have in this country is guided, I put down here at the bottom, is largely guided by corporate control. No surprise to anyone. And some of those corporate players, Monsanto,
Cargill,
I'm thinking of
ADM.
Yeah, ADM, IBP, Iowa
Beef Packers.
I'm trying to think of some of the other big players. All the all the big seed companies.
Yeah,
Novartis and seed and all these different folks that are
probably
players.
Your companies supplying the majority of the seed.
Right.
Even the organic guys get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a pretty funneled economic model here that really has a few players dominating much of the control of our current agriculture. And the first thing I put down there is that it's a very production-oriented agriculture. We tend to talk, and this is something that Margaret and I started talking about, that when you talk with farmers, there are these range of things that farmers are comfortable talking about. And one of them is, you know, horsepower. There's this whole language, and it's horsepower, and it's bushels to the acre, and it's, you know, hundredweight per dairy cow, and there's this kind of this, you know, limited range of things that people, you know, can talk about. But it tends to be sort of a lot of our success in agriculture is being measured by bushels to the acre.
Or bins per acre.
Or
fruit.
Apples,
yeah,
or other things. And the thing that we're missing in that equation is everything that it's taken for us to achieve that level. Now, what we're experiencing in the Midwest, this year we had a drought in much of the upper Midwest, and the high end of the range of corn was somewhere around 160 bushels an acre, and all of a sudden farmers are disappointed in what would have been a record crop 8 or 10 years ago, because we're on this pattern of continuing to just press those yields higher and higher and higher. And the question is, how long can we sustain this production-oriented agriculture? What are the upper limits of nature and of our own intervention in that? And I put a word here, plant-centric. Production agriculture, as it's designed today in this country, tends to be not only yield-oriented, but it's also focused primarily on this year's crop, exclusively. There's very little thinking on the large farms in this country. And what you're missing then is you're missing crop rotations, thinking in longer term, let's say 3 to 5 years. 90% of the farmland in Iowa is now two crops, corn and soybeans. And the distinction here, it's focused primarily, I'll give you an example, having grown up in Idaho. The potatoes are the soil the potatoes are grown in Idaho now has almost no organic matter left, none. So it really ceases to be soil. It's just dirt.
Well, basically sand.
Okay. And what this production-oriented model of agriculture is saying is, we'll provide everything else. The only thing we need is for the soil, what formerly could have been called soil, to just hold up the plant. That's all we're asking from it. So it's a plant-centric. Most of our technologies, most of our focus is on the yield of a certain plant. And we'll see when we go across. Should we go across that, or just keep going down?
What? Okay.
And then I'll take the one across, and then we can each jump across. By contrast to that, in terms of thinking sustainably, we talk about feeding the soil, not the plant. It's one of the main axioms in organic farming. And if we're looking at soil and soil health, if you have a healthy soil, many of the other problems that are related to this type of an input-oriented production agriculture are systematic of stress, essentially. And if you take and start feeding the soil, and this, I worked with the high school kids once last week and then once this week. Jenny was there today, and maybe she can add some to it. But what I was essentially talking about is this whole notion that soil is alive, and that there are all of these microorganisms working to create that process of regeneration, and that's what we're trying to do in organic farming, is look at it in terms of a cyclical nature instead of a linear process. In production agriculture, you just take inputs and you keep It's like force feeding an animal. You know, you just keep putting them in, putting them in, putting them in, and you're very focused on this one outcome. And in a more sustainable farming practices, you're thinking long term, first of all, and you're thinking more about the overall health of the soil as opposed to the yield of any one given crop that year.
That takes a lot. I mean, I was in a CSA this year for the first time. I have a better appreciation for what's going on, and this takes more land.
Exactly. And we're now realizing on our farm that we're producing more food than our land can sustain. Mm-hmm. And our CSA needs to be smaller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to figure out is then how our income and the economic health of our farm needs to shift or change as a result of that.
But it was showing which areas, what's going to happen next year and everything.
We have a one-to-one ratio of land in production and land that's fallow or in cover crops. Almost all of us in cover crops. And we're now realizing that ratio probably needs to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1-3, 1-4. So we're looking at needing twice the tillable land that we have in order to do this long-term soil building and looking at this overall picture of soil health and sustainability that we've got to extend that rotation. So you want to give an answer?
Well, I would just add about this too is another way that I think of it is, you know, if the soil's healthy and the plant's healthier and not as stressed, it's just like us, our immune system, if we're healthier, our immune system. So there's all those kinds of diseases and things out there, but we're not getting them. And that's the same with the plants too. Even insects, you know, that will come and attack them, but they don't overcome the plants when they're healthy. So that's a big part of the whole thing. Well, I don't know. Why don't you and Grant just kind of go back and forth? Then why don't I throw in stuff where I feel comfortable? Because I don't know technological answers, and you guys can go through the soil on that.
And you can pick anyone you feel comfortable with. We don't have to just read the order. We can just check them.
Technological answers to biological questions. So to me, this means the farmer has no choices on his land anymore. Technology is driving his decisions. Economics is driving his decisions. He knows that if he's got a soil that's dead, to get that potato crop up and produce the bushels per acre he needs, he's going to have to come up with a stronger fertilizer. And as the insects become more immune to the insecticides he uses, he's going to depend on technology to bring him a more powerful insecticide and getting it licensed and online in a timely manner so he can use it. And then with all that, you got to increase in your production machinery. So if you got to all of a sudden fumigate your soil with some ammonia or some fumigant, you got to have the blankets to cover that field, or the injection system to put that underground and then cover it. It's a mess. The organic guy, he looks at a natural way of fumigation, and that, to him, it might be just as simple as growing mustards. Mustard is a natural producer of, mustard gas. It's a natural green toxic way to take care of soil-borne diseases. And it's one that organic guys are going a lot with. But the one that worries me more here, unless it's somewhere else, is the GMO issue. Because that is really being driven. That's driving agriculture so fast that we can't even keep up as a civilization. They're not telling us what they're doing till after it's already out and it's too late to do anything about it. So as a consumer, or as a farmer even, you know, we're behind the curve. Technology is way ahead of us out there. And by the time it comes to the farmer to use, it's everybody else is doing it, you know. How am I going to get this many bushel per acre if I'm not doing this too? So you got to get out of this rut, you got to be a planner and a decision maker, and you got to know your farm, you got to know your soil, know your crops, and know your limitations and your thresholds which you can live with, and the amount of failure you can take on. Mm-hmm. So for me, let's take one crop. Okay. Let's say I'm going to go with the strongest. Let's talk about apples here. I'm going to go to the spray material warehouse, and I'm going to pick up the latest, strongest material out there. Why? Because I only have to drive the tractor and the sprayer through the orchard 4 times instead of 14 times. Mm-hmm. I can go get some other weaker material, but there's added cost in the application and the labor in doing it. Well, for me, the solution isn't in off-farm inputs, it's more biological solutions. What can I do as a permanent fix as an apple grower? Should I use a pheromone confusion? Well, to me that would be all right. I mean, it's good technology and it's new technology and it's getting mainstream. But take it one step farther. Isn't there a way that nature cycles in the natural orchards where the apple originated, in Athabasca, Russia, or wherever it came from? I mean, there's natural predators out there. We just have to find what they are, put the research and the technology into getting them to the point where a farmer can access them and use them, and use that as a long-term solution. So like for my whole goal as an apple grower is to get to where I'm zero spraying, period, no sprays. And so the thrust of my technological research that I'm dependent on as an organic grower is the insectaries out of California that are raising these natural predator insects and producing them in a cheap enough to where it's an accessible tool for me to use. So I can go out and buy the stuff, but what's going to make it work if I be spraying? If I don't understand this life cycle of that insect, I might use a biological insecticide. It's just wiped out all the predators I bought. You about have to be an entomologist, and a decision maker if you're going to go that route.
An apple world.
If you're going to go that route. Otherwise, you can let GMOs produce you corn that's got BT in it, or Roundup Ready soybean, that eliminates all that. You don't have to think about natural predators. You're just going to wipe them all out. Anyway, that's what all that technology means to me. I'm sure it means something to other people too. But
I was just going to ask on that. Have any of you read Prodigal Summer?
Yeah.
Because to me, I felt that that little lesson in the orchard when she's explaining the predator insects, longer life cycle or something. But anyway, when you spray everything.
Right.
Then you spray your predators, which you really need. Yeah, and then the other insects, they have a shorter life cycle, so they can reproduce quicker and take over. So it was a good explanation for a layperson.
Another book to read, which is really a foundation book, is Silent Spring, which is Rachel Carson, 1965, really looking at DDT and some of the problems. And when DDT first came out, they had advertisements showing people drinking it, saying how safe it was.
Yeah.
And my dad tells a story about a neighboring farmer who died from DDT exposure. And so he has a personal experience with that. But you think that we would learn about Margaret likes to use the word hubris, and that's really what describes it, is the arrogance with which we're, attempting to solve these problems. We tend to think, okay, we've gotten ourselves in an environmental problem here. Go back to the potato grower. Grant was saying, well, we're just going to think of a new technological fix.
And it's always short-term.
Well, at some point, we're going to run out of technological fixes, and a lot of these technological fixes are creating so many added layers of problems that our society is having to deal with indirectly. So let's move on down. Large scale versus small scale. And this is not as clear cut, because there are a few examples of some large scale farmers who are actually doing things pretty sustainably. I think about Fred Kirschman in North Dakota, who farms 3,000 acres not only organically but biodynamically, which involves the spraying of these preparations and other things, which is a whole other metaphysical way of approaching soil, land, and plants and everything. But by and large,
it does depend on what you're growing too. Yeah. You know, and I guess
he's a wheat grower.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's growing grains, out there in North Dakota.
So we'll try and throw that in as we think of it. But remember that the closer you get to, to the sustainable and organic, we're smaller scale. So we're vegetables, grounds cut, orchards. I'm loving learning about this because I don't know about orchards.
But we're talking about a scale that's quickly becoming staggering. We were talking at breakfast this morning about R.D. Offutt, the largest potato grower in the United States, who now has more than 100,000 acres in 13 states. Okay, he's based out of Fargo. J.R. Simplot, who has 30,000 acres in Idaho alone, another 30,000 in Oregon, and he has something like 100,000 cows out in the desert in Idaho, where all the feed is brought to him, the water's trucked to him, piped to him, everything. So we're really talking about kind of a new level of concentration and scale. And
in all that, you can subtract any intimacy towards the land or knowing the land.
Well, it's largely driven by the, we have to feed the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which the church has played a role in. We talked about that the other night a little bit.
We don't have to feed the world.
Right.
We have to feed our community.
Yeah.
Right. And unfortunately, this large-scale model is what's being exported then to Brazil and other frontiers around the world, where we're going to, we think we have the most efficient agriculture in the world, but we're just looking at such a narrow few indicators of how we quantify that as the most efficient. And unfortunately, we're disregarding all of these other side effects. But this whole scale question, what we're losing here is we're losing the intimacy. I gave each of the high school kids what I called an organic axiom, and they each had to read them aloud to the class, and one of them is one that I really enjoy that says that the best fertilizer is the farmer's footsteps. This whole notion that if a farmer's out walking on their land and knows it intimately, and I think about the GPS systems are such a perfect example of having technology gone awry. If you're familiar with the whole GPS technology, tractors have it, combines have it. Our neighbor's corn planter now costs $60,000 primarily because of just the computer circuitry and all of the satellite technology in a corn planter. So what it's doing is as he travels through the field, the planter's being told to increase the plant population in certain parts of the field and decrease it in certain parts of the field, or apply more fertilizer or back off on the fertilizer, but all of it through computer technologies. Well, all of that is just a substitute for the old farmers that we bought our farm from. Five bachelor farmers can tell you where every rocky spot is and every, where the frost leaves the land the last, and where you have certain pockets of certain weeds, and where the fertility was always just a bit better. It was an intimacy. And that intimacy is very difficult on a large scale. Pretty obvious.
So if you get 160 bushels per acre of corn, and corn is $1.30, they talked about at least in the Dell field.
Right, it's now over two. It's about $2.30 right now.
Okay, mm-hmm. So that's $300,
right.
Per acre.
Right.
And so it seems kind of obvious that you have to farm a lot of acres.
Right.
But where does it get to? I mean, does a farmer who's farming a lot of acres do it because they want a lot more money, or because they have to pay off things?
I think the video described it well in that the profit margins are so thin. Mm-hmm. In that video, they talked about the just the input costs in corn alone are right around $2.05. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you got 30 cents a bushel.
So you've got that buffer is pretty thin there.
Down.
And yeah. So when your profit margins are that thin, you just have a lot more of it. I mean, it's just supply and demand economics.
Right.
And that's where scale comes into play very quickly. And this is happening with dairy cows. There was a permit near where my folks live for a 13,000 cow dairy where they implant computer chips in the cow's left leg as they walk in the barn. Now, my grandmother, whose family brought 5 dairy cows with them from Switzerland here in the 1880s, knew every cow that walked in the barn and who its mother was and its grandmother and what its feed, you know, ration was and everything. That's intimacy. And now, most of the milkers come, they're out of South America. You know, they bring in people from other countries. There's and this computer technology, we're kind of bouncing back to some of these other ones. But scale, so on the flip side,
I just want to answer Casey's question a little bit more. Yeah, they'd probably get bigger and bigger, and at this point, it's probably just to stay above water,
mm-hmm.
just to keep afloat.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Well, the debt load in farming right now is just enormous.
Yeah. And then I think also, I just think of the family behind us, and I guess I can talk about them.
They're
because
not here.
Nobody knows them. Nice family. I mean, we like them as neighbors and all. But they come from this family that has all this land, and there's this competition, and there's, you know, cousins hating cousins. And it's nobody stopping and saying, whoa, wait a minute, how did this get so awful and dysfunctional, but it was just drive, and pretty soon it's just out of control, and you know, if they were to stop and say why, I don't know, they'd have a very good answer.
Mm-hmm. Do you have the same economics? Because I don't think that the CSA that I belong to has this money problem. Is that general?
Organic farmers
have the same economic problems that other farmers?
All farmers do because of cheap food.
I mean, you don't have as much equipment.
Well, I'll tell you.
But the CSA model
we went without
is
health
different than
Yeah, we went without health insurance for 5 years with small children.
Okay.
So, you know, we're still talking about, we still have a ways to go to be honest with our members and say, you know, if this is really important, we've got to figure out a way that we don't burn out. And that we do provide for the next generation of farmers, and that we've got some big questions to ask.
It's not sustainable.
That's
right.
And I would say that one of the things that I like to say is that we're changing the way we farm in the organic farming movement, but we're not necessarily changing the way we market.
Mm-hmm. Except in the CSA.
The CSA is the one exception to that. But what we're seeing is organic prices coming down, and more corporate players getting involved in organics.
Organic.
Horizon Dairy is a perfect example. Horizon Dairy, somewhere between 30 and 50,000 organic milk cows in the West, and they put a conventional dairy with an organic dairy, and how they deal with this biological solution about mastitis and other problems, they just take the cow from the organic dairy and walk it across to the conventional dairy and treat it, and that's their solution. Now, our neighboring farmer would treat a cow, and you know, their certification would be in jeopardy for 7 years. That's what we're talking about in terms of these corporate. There's the letter of the law, and then there's the spirit of the law. And we are seeing more and more large-scale players, including Dole, they're a large importer of organic fruits out of South America and other places and stuff. So the economic piece is working better.
And let me just say, too, about a CSA, since you're familiar with that, and other people, I think, know that community-supported agriculture, that you have to realize there, it's direct marketing, but then you have to realize the farmer is the grower, the produce manager, the deliverer, what else? You know, quality control person.
Right.
Yes, right.
PR.
PR. The whole,
right.
You know, and all of those things.
A lot of hats we wear. Yeah.
And we do it gladly. I'm not complaining at all, but that's why there's more direct money. And in these other things, you put all those things in, and pretty soon the farmer gets less and less and less.
Instead of growing a commodity, you're growing a niche crop.
Yeah.
And you're willing to market it instead of letting the broker market it.
Uh-huh.
That's the basic difference.
Well, and what's hard about niches is niches change. So I don't like to like to use that language.
I like the idea of instead of commodity, food.
Right.
Because that sort of, but it is,
Ed,
it's in that
Ed,
area.
Do you want to add something here?
Yeah, I was going to go back to one thing to add to what Casey, to answer Casey's question. I think about 8 or 10 years ago, wheat was $5 a bushel. It had gone up from, and now it's like $2.80 on a good day. But when wheat kind of steadily went up, then farmers replaced a lot of old equipment with new equipment. And then the price dropped.
And all that debt.
So they, but the debt is still the same. So then they need to maximize the use of, you know, this big tractor. Then they need to be able to use it more hours a day. And I think that added to the larger model. People having to feel they farm more just to pay off their debt. The debt load on the tractor that the guy farms for my brother and I, part of it, he does a lot with us, but his debt load is $13,000 a year just for his tractor. And then repairs, he took it into the shop, that was $5,000 just to get it out of the shop. So he doesn't certainly make that on the 160 acres.
A lot of people are profiting off of farmers. And debt is really
equipment
the road that gets people in trouble.
Yeah. And the people who jump when things go up.
Right. Grant, do you want to take the next one? Conservation of animals.
Yeah.
I mean, I was alluding to some of it with some examples and other things.
Because of the low profit margin, the same thing is happening in the livestock industry. And to be successful in huge agriculture, you got to be raising hundreds and hundreds of critters, all the same kind in a confinement situation that isn't necessarily healthy at all. And chances are you're getting a lot of cullage and a lot of loss due to that. And the disease problems increased, and the manure waste problems increased, so you become a manager of waste. Where on the other hand, if you're raising livestock on a small operation, it's the intimacy again. It's, you know each animal, you know its health, you know it when it's having a bad day. And you can give those animals individual attention they need and look after them like they're your family and actually make them an important part of your farm as opposed to a way to receive income. And then when you integrate them into your farm and use them to keep yourself from going to the chemical distributor, then you've got one step closer to sustainability.
And there's this relationship. That animal is not just money in the bank for you. It's your helpmate in helping.
I was just going to say, I always thought the cows on our farm were my dad's partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
Well, and then you get in, you know, that the old term animal husbandry, mm-hmm. you know, where there's this relationship, and it's, you know, there's sort of a circle in it of some kind.
Well, I was this is kind of a dangerous road to step down, but the whole question about, you know, being a vegetarian or a vegan, I think animals play a very, very important role in agriculture. Mm-hmm. Because they're able to capture the stored energy from photosynthesis and process it in a way that we can't through other types of vegetation. We can't store other types of vegetation. Animals can. They're designed to store and transfer photosynthesis, and that's really what agriculture is all about, is photosynthesis and following and capturing light. And that's not to say, because I do say in here, I have on this other list of things to do, I'll cheat on that and just say eating less meat is very important, because what we've done is, cattle in particular are ruminants. They're designed to have forage and, you know, coarse fibrous feed, and that's how their digestive system works. And what we've done in this country is we're force feeding them grain in confinement operations, and that is a very dangerous road to go down. Michael Pollan, who does a lot of writing around agricultural issues, has a really good essay. I think it was in the New York Times Sunday, or the New York Times Magazine maybe. And I think it was called Cow 534. He buys this cow and takes it through the whole process from birth in South Dakota to slaughter in Kansas. And it's a very, very revealing expose about the treatment of animals. And that this goes, you know, and if you're eating, I'm getting ahead of myself, but, you know, watch, if, you know, knowing your farmer and knowing where your meat's coming from is, you know, a nice first step.
Well,
but,
and let me just say something about this, and I think Grant also can tell you specifically on his farm, but we've been paying a little more attention to that, and it's a very exciting thing going on right now. And in a state newspaper that's an agricultural newspaper, we've been reading several really good, kind of like, you know, big success stories of the farmer deciding he's going to just get out of dairy, and then they decide to go to pasture raised, and pretty soon there's not as many inputs, and the sun's taking over. And my favorite one was, and basically what you do is, you know, you put your cows on pasture because that's what they're meant to eat. And we also know, too, with our farm, we've done partnerships with other farms, and one is a dairy, and it's called Pasture Land Dairy, and it's a group of five farmers who have all committed themselves to raising their cows on pasture. And there's all these benefits for the cows and them, for us also. And one of the things is the butter is more yellow, and it's got these omega-3 fatty acids that are actually good for you, instead of all this, you know, we gave up butter and went to margarine for our health. And now we're finding if we raise cows the right way, then it's okay for us. And
well, this, follow the same example of this pasture land dairy. The average number of lactations for an industrial dairy, cow and industrial dairy, is under 3. They're
so
just burned up.
3 years.
They stuff them with grain. They're maximizing the production, and it's just the cow just is destroyed. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 4 and 5 year old animals that just are spent because of what we've done to them in this high production oriented agriculture. And pasture land, I think, is somewhere between 8 and 10 lactations a cow. Now, look at, on the economic side, what that means in terms of your replacement heifers, mm-hmm. and your investment and protecting that investment. That's this animal husbandry or soil stewardship or however you want to look at it. And these folks on pasture this year weathered the drought. In parts of Wisconsin, they started feeding hay on August 1st this year. Some years, we don't start till December 1st. That's how bad the drought was in parts of Wisconsin this year. Worst drought in 25 years. The folks on pasture that were managing their pasture properly didn't have to do any supplemental feeding. They were able to rotate through their pastures, and because it was a sod, they weren't losing as much of that moisture, capturing that, you know, making the most out of what they had there. Susan?
So if their land available to raise, to have enough farm, you know, for people to have small enough farms, because we have given up so much land for development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So is there land to have pasture to raise the number of cattle that we feel that we need or whatever? I mean, is the land there anymore?
Well, the land is there. It's, you know, the saying that asphalt is the last crop, you know, in terms of development. But one of the things that I put on this other list is that we need more farmers, and we've got to go knocking on the door of production agriculture and essentially demand for some of this land back. And I think at our organic farming conference, which is one of the largest conferences in the country, farming conferences in the Midwest, organic farmers are now starting to call themselves peasants.
Peasants.
Tyson, it's the Tyson family farms.
Yeah.
You know, they own 40% of all the poultry in the country.
So if you say you're the family farm.
And so the word peasant is now resonating more with how we see ourselves.
And then it's more global.
We also can stand in solidarity with the landless peasants throughout Central and Latin America that are going and squatting and saying, we want our land back. That's been taken from us, this ancestral land. But the land issues are going to be more and more important, in particular when you start looking at some of these technological fixes, this production orientation. It's a land grabbing business. Mm-hmm. And at some point, communities have to say, we're going to put some land in a land trust. And we're going to take it out of this speculation. Our farm is in a land trust. We have a conservation easement on our farm. It can never be sold. Okay, it can never be sold for development. So we sold the development rights. That's long term. That's a covenant. It's like a marriage for us. And that's more of what we need to do. We need to find tools for farmers to stay on farms, get more people involved in agriculture, and to protect the farmland we have. And that's a question for all of us. That's not a question just for farmers.
If that's going to happen, there's got to be a working model out there that the new upstart farmer can see a way to a success. If you're raised on a farm and you see your family fail, chances are you're not going to keep farming.
Right.
But the American Farmland Trust is doing that, I thought. I thought they had some farms that were sort of like the demonstration farms.
Right. The American Farmland Trust is trying, I think the organization that's probably doing a better job is the Vermont Land Trust. And for me, when I look for solutions, I look east. Where people have lived on the landscape longer, they've had to work harder at solving the problems. They've just had more time to confront the problems. And Vermont is now buying the state's farms and putting them in trust to be held by the people of the state.
Well, I'm in Pennsylvania, and that's my CSA is...
Is it community land trust or...
The land trust that I work with got the county to get the Pennsylvania agricultural right thing. So it's got an easement on it, too, through the state program.
And this type of investment that we're talking about in soil and plants and this intimacy and stuff does not work in this, cash sale farmland scenario that's developed in this country. We've got to take it out of that completely. Rick?
Yeah, it does seem to me on the land versus farmland versus development issue that particularly in a market-oriented organic farming, direct marketing to customers, you need some proximity to customer base. Mm-hmm. And, if you had that experience with the group in Egan, if you're driven farther and farther away from the market, then your transport costs go up and your...
It's that tension point, right? Where the development is displacing the farmland. The most diverse farms we have in the country are right on that exurban fringe around most metropolitan areas. And that's the place where the most tension is.
Well, historically, that's where a lot of the produce for the city was grown.
It's always right at the truck farms.
That's a lot where the small farmers that are doing organic, saying what kind of farming are doing that, right on the urban fringe. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the reasons closest to market. And that's one I know real well, because I'm so isolated over here that making the choice to sell what I grow myself is a huge commitment. That's almost bigger than actually growing the stuff, getting this to market from little Eastern Washington here where nobody even cares if it's organic. You get over the other side of the mountains all of a sudden, you don't care.
Well, I think one of
the population doesn't care.
Well, one of the problems we have with development is this whole idea of concentric circles of development. And in European cities, they've maintained these pockets. In France, for example, all land is valued for its agricultural value. And before any other use, whether it's privately held or not, it has to be evaluated by a state-run board, which determines its suitability for development purpose or something. So you have, for example, in Paris, 3 miles from the Eiffel Tower, working truck farms. And then houses clustered in and around them to provide the needs of the city, but you've maintained these green arteries of farmland. So, Harry, did you have something to add earlier?
Yeah, it was more of a question. Well, it's kind of all interrelated to the scale and the animal, but I don't know if it's a separate topic where the meat, the livestock eat the silage, besides the pasture. They're an integral part of the farm. And instead of manure being waste product, it's an input for agriculture. But from that, I was going to ask, it was somebody's question about, is there enough land? is, my question is, do we not have enough land, or is the land malapportioned? And this may in part be because of the amount of meat in our diet, but also if the animals are not fed that way, we are devoting agricultural land, a significant portion of it, almost more than people, toward raising feed as an input for the livestock, because everything is isolated and concentrated things. So if that amount of land was reapportioned more like grants is, does it really take more acreage?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example.
Yeah, I think we have to start looking at a whole different way, because like you say, if we changed all these farming practices, farms as we see them now would not look like they do. No.
I'll give you something that might be analogous to this. The Soviet food system essentially collapsed around the time that their society, political was taking place. And what it had to do with was this idea that you could take the independent states within the Soviet Union and have them become great monocultures, in a sense. So you take one province, for example, and you would just grow cotton. And it would grow cotton year after year after year with very little rotation in there. And the Soviet Union was always producing enough food, but they couldn't get it. They had these tremendous supply and distribution problems trying to crisscross the country with all this kind of stuff. But during that whole time, they started realizing that almost half of the food in the country was raised in people's dochas, Ed and I were talking about. And it's these little country villas that people have, oftentimes half an acre, three quarters acre. They might have a cow, they might have a pig, they've got a few fruit trees, they've got a few chickens, and they go out there on the weekend. It's a very important part of Russian life, to go to these dochas. And that's where the food, that's how people were being fed. It wasn't this great, you know, production-oriented agriculture that was consuming all this land and destroying great parts of the country environmentally. But it was in these small little plots. And, you know, John Jevons, who's a, I don't know if you're familiar with his pioneering work in biointensive agriculture, which is real small scale, believes that just the suburban lawn space in this country is enough to feed the people in this country.
Whoa, seriously?
That's
now get rid of that lawn chemicals.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a family of three or four people, how much food they could produce? I mean, that's not hard to believe at all.
Right. The thing that's...
The energy, though, the time and energy for each of us to do that, if we're also going to have teachers and, you know, musicians and doctors and all that.
Right. The thing that's missing in this suburban example is the little known fact that most of the topsoil is sold in most developments.
It's what?
It's sold.
It's shoveled off.
The topsoil is skimmed off and sold. And that's one of the things I just absolutely think it's a sin. I don't think you should be able to sell topsoil.
Yeah.
And the largest buyer of topsoil in the Midwest are typically municipalities for, you know, creating new roadways and parks and this kind of stuff. So I've had these suburban homeowners say, we've tried to garden, and we just can't get a garden to grow, and you go out and stick the shovel in the ground, and they've got 4 inches, enough to grow grass, is all the developers have left them. So, Rick.
Well, we talked about this stuff a little bit, and one of the things I was impressed with there is how important urban gardens are in feeding Havana. I mean, just yards that have been converted and
gardens.
Cuba
gardens and planting boxes and just they're so desperate for food.
Cuba is really the model for the world.
They're leading the way, yeah.
80% of the food in Havana is organic. 80% grown in these organoponical projects is what they're called. It's based on the Chinese model of intensively raised vegetables. And what the government allowed is for these small gardeners and farmers to, they have to meet their state quota, which is 80% of what they produce. But then that 20% they can sell on the open market. And so you now have the wealthiest members of the Cuban society are small organic farmers. Because they have something to sell.
20%.
You know, there's a lot of money in Cuban society because they've been paid this you know, this monthly, they receive their rations and their stipend every month, and there's no consumer goods to spend it on. And so they go to the market and they just spend lavishly on garlic and things that can't be grown in this industrial, industrial.
They're kind of forced into that because the unplugging of what the big agriculture has here.
Yeah.
Right.
So we're in favor.
They're forced that way. And the number one group that's trying to lobby against the embargo is the petrochemical companies and corporate agriculture.
Not in their chemicals.
Some of them already have offices in the country trying to set up the network. So when it collapses, they're in place. They're there.
When it collapses, as in when people don't have enough food, when it's
basically the U.S. if they want to destabilize Cuba at this point, all they have to do is drop the embargo
and
infuse a lot of cash into the society, and it could change everything overnight.
Yeah.
I want to go back to Gary's question, as long as we're talking about corporate control, because that question of meat and a diet is definitely, there's a lot of corporate drive behind that. We don't need as much meat as we've been told. We don't need as much milk as we've been told. And one example is the beef checkoff and the pork checkoff. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's it's run by the big, the corporate beef packers and stuff. And that everybody who sells a cow needs to pay $1. Pay $1. And then all the advertising, that money then goes towards advertising, promoting.
Pork, the other white meat, perfect example.
Yeah.
Now, hundreds of millions of dollars.
The small farmers have been fighting that, and also mushroom growers, because it started with a mushroom checkoff, the same thing. And it has been handed out in the Supreme Court of the United States, right, with the mushroom checkoff?
Well, the Bush administration is trying to take it to the Supreme Court, but they're not sure that the Supreme Court's going to accept it because the precedent's been set now. So the beef checkoff fell, the mushroom checkoff fell, and now the pork checkoff fell.
And so it is a victory for the small farmer, but they're saying it's unconstitutional for us to have to pay for something we don't believe in. And so
Washington State Applebee's.
Yeah,
same
thing.
They
tell that story.
That's right.
Because they were doing that, and they lost
to
the state Supreme Court.
And so it's quite that whole thing was started by just a few small growers here in the Chelan area. That whole movement. So
it
can show you what.
Get rid of it? Yeah.
Yeah. That can show you what.
And did they got rid of it, or they just they got
small grassroots?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a real success.
Red apple. They can no longer use that. Isn't that it? They can't use it anymore.
The apple commission is gone. There is no such thing as
wash up this out here and then
you're
gone.
It's a piece of history now.
I don't know if this relates, but I've been thinking about it as you're talking. My mom tells about in the Depression, they never worried. Because on the farm they always had enough. They had eggs, they had chickens, they had cows for milk and butter, and they butchered and they had gardens. And they never, anybody that came to the door, they never sent them away. They always invited them into meetings.
And that security probably gave them hope to get through that era.
Yeah.
There were a lot of farmers that didn't know there was a depression.
Yeah.
Then, other than maybe some of their markets changed, but
they
were able to sustain themselves. You know, this things were intact there. Now, if that happened today, that'd be a different story. I thought since the conversation's kind of shifted a little bit, I thought instead of overburdening you with keep pounding this list, I think you guys are kind of getting the picture. But here's the thing. So we currently have an agriculture that looks a lot like this, and this is where agriculture is hopefully headed, but all of you are standing in between here and there. All right, there are no spectators.
You're very powerful.
And
I know that. Very powerful.
And so I put together, three of us talked, and we put together a list here, and I'll just run through it quickly, and then we can kind of throw the discussion back open, and if you want to talk more specifically about certain practices. There are no spectators. We're all participants. And the other thing is I belong to a couple organizations in the Midwest that refuse to use the word consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's a fairly passive act. Consumptive is not. I mean, consumptive is an action, but consumerism as it's developed in our capitalistic society, it doesn't carry with it the rights and responsibilities that is implied in other actions. And so we tend to use the word eaters. It's hard to argue with that. So consumer is a word that I don't like to hear related. Jen, did you want to add something to that?
But I have to add that, like, when I was working in demographics, like, the U.S. Census Bureau refers to people a lot as consumers. And maybe that's because instead of, like, citizens, you know, they're
right.
not as citizens of the country,
right.
so maybe it's more inclusive. But
right.
still, it's disturbing to me, too.
Right.
Or maybe that's just how they see us, because that's our only value, too.
Right.
Yeah, consumers are the people that buy the other white meat. I mean,
right. Right, without thinking, without
the
values.
It's the whole
values.
Psychology of the
right.
overproduction you produce,
yeah.
and then somebody has to...
Right.
And what were we told after 9/11? Go out and buy. You know, the best thing you can do.
Yeah. So let me just run down this list of what all of you can do. Eat foods in season. Eat locally grown foods whenever and wherever possible. If you're traveling to other places, it's one of our favorite things. We don't travel that much, but try and find... We go to co-ops and visit farms and look for farm stands, and it's just part of our travels when we go places. So local could be wherever you are. Consume less meat.
Oh,
back related to the whole, you know, stuffing grain down animals. Get to know local farmers. Visit farms. Volunteer, intern. You know, go out for work for a day on a farm. Join a community-supported farm. This is not an advertisement for us.
Can't try
all the CSAs here and stuff. But it really is a model that is providing some hope and is working.
I have to tell you, I had friends who had been in this farm for 3 or 4 years, and so they finally, I found out they had half shares, so I could do that. And it's just changed my whole way of eating, my whole way of thinking about things. And I did it because I believed in the concept. And you've got something about the economy down there, you know, the cost of the food. I'm sitting there thinking, boy, this is really expensive because you write this check up front,
right.
you know? Mm-hmm. But then all summer long, I wasn't spending hardly any money, you know?
Yeah,
I wasn't really going to buy
and
anything.
And you weren't going to the grocery store and buying the things that weren't
And I was making
list,
myself eat what I had because I'd spent
right.
all that money,
and you're
you know?
Well,
and I was feeling very horribly guilty if I wasn't going to do something
with
the food, you know?
Right.
Okay, sometimes guilt's good.
It just changed my whole way of eating.
I'm just curious, on your half a share, was that under $200?
It was $250, and I think I went and worked twice, and that made it less.
That brought it down.
Yeah, yeah. And I would go. I went every other week.
Would you go to the farm to pick the stuff up, or was
it? Yeah, it was a little more expensive if you went to a place where he delivered it in the city. And, you know, and I sat there and I debated the whole drive out there in the car,
mm-hmm.
got, you know, the gas, whole issue of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that part of it I needed to have that drive out.
That connection to the farm.
Right.
I needed to have
right.
that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing was wonderful.
You can't place a monetary
value. Yeah, it's changed my whole perception of food and how I eat.
Do you feel like a half a share was adequate for you, or?
Yeah.
You wish you had a whole share? Were you sharing that half a share with other people? Or?
No.
It was just about
If I would travel, I would sometimes give things to neighbors, but...
Mm-hmm. Diane,
but
I was just going to say that we belong to a CSA in Olympia, and we bought a share with another family.
To split it.
Two families of four, I think. Yeah, and it was $2.50 for a half a share, and that was all the vegetable we could eat.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your season? He's thinking about doing a winter season next year. I went to pick up 10 pounds of potatoes
they,
2 weeks ago.
Did they have any meat
thing.
Or fruits available, or was all...
A little bit of fruit.
So they're getting some stuff out of Eastern Washington? Adding it to all berries and that kind of...
Mm-hmm.
Let me just finish going down this list here. Gardening, of course, is a natural first step. Anytime you get your hands in the soil, you're all of a sudden not part of this side of the equation here.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're gardening... you know, in a potted plant on your patio or community garden or something more. So it's a wonderful first step. Join a cooperative food market or a food co-op. It's a wonderful place to start thinking more about the politics of food and how your individual decisions are having larger impacts on some of these issues here. Put food by. You know, I just feel so, I was saying this to Grant, in our office downstairs, we have a picture of Grant's pantry. with about 150 jars of canned goods. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's the only thing in the frame of the picture. And I just feel so rich just even looking at the photo. Mm-hmm. It's just this wonderful satisfaction of knowing, that for me is wealth. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. that for me is just one of the most satisfying things when we go home to pull stuff out of the freezer and canned goods and we eat so well. It's year round. It's just so wonderful. Join sustainable farming organizations. You know, find out who's working on issues locally. Who worked on this apple checkoff? You know, get involved with them and send them a check for some money to help them kind of work. It's a pretty wide network with a lot of players, and there's, you know, a lot of these organizations need people like you to support what they're doing.
Us in Washington and Oregon is Tilth.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And Tilth is also a producer's organization as well as a gardener's organization. Urban. There's several Tilth chapters in this state in Oregon, too, that include urban areas.
And they've been around for a long
time. They run really neat operations with community pea patches and community greenhouses.
And I'd like to suggest that maybe Holden could take out an associate membership in Washington Tilth and send somebody to the annual conference every year. You know, as a way of staying directly involved in the larger current of food issues. Katie's volunteering. No, you went last year, didn't you?
No, I was in the right city when it happened this year.
Okay.
We were
there that day.
Well, great.
But we didn't.
So, advocate for changing the federal farm policy. This is a big issue. It's going to take a lot of people. I would love to see the churches be able to get more involved in this issue. But right now, our federal farm subsidy program is a big part of the problem. The money is following the power, and a lot of it's ending up in corporate pockets. So that's something that has to change. We've got to figure out ways for our federal farm programs to reward stewardship and sustainability. We're trying hard to make that happen. We had two things passed in the last farm bill. And the thing that's important about the farm bills, it's only once every 7 years. So you've got to work hard, because what you get, you're stuck with for 7 years. And it just happened in 2001. So 2008, organizations are already preparing themselves. But the Bush administration is refusing to fully fund two or three of the stewardship platforms that passed in the farm bill. They're just sitting on it in conference committee. They will not fund them. Okay, so this is the kind of advocacy that a community like ours needs to work on. So maybe I can get more information to Diane, and we could propose that as an advocacy sometime. Become a farmer. We need more farmers. And it's, you know, if you like working outside and physical work and spiritually rewarding work and using all of your senses and being challenged, I can't think of anything better than farming. And there's a community of people out there.
The being challenged
farmers. Yeah, farmers to work for and organizations to help you get started.
It's fun. I mean, it's great people to hang out with.
Spend more time cooking.
There you go.
Yeah.
Just get closer to food. Just, you know, and it happens with the cooks here all the time. The cooks show up and say, I don't know anything about cooking. And we leave here really, really intimately involved with food. It's a wonderful thing. And where does that lead you? It leads you to the next step. You know, I want to get my hands in the soil, or I want to know what's next. Now, the last one right here is buy organic.
B-U-Y.
Okay, whoops. Local is best. But I didn't put that at the top of the list. Partly because of this whole letter of the law and spirit of the law. There's a lot of tricks out there in organics. And I still really believe that buying locally, eating foods in season, organic or not, there's these different layers of sustainability. And this, you know, you really need to know what's going on with the labeling process in order to you know, the whole organic thing. It's not to say shy away from it, but it's becoming more and more complex. So it's not the first thing necessarily on this list of things for all of you to do. So,
I was just thinking of a great example of that is kiwis from New Zealand that are organic.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're from New Zealand, right?
Yeah.
They're really, really long ways from home. there's apples in Whatcom County. I mean, you could just go to the store and get apples that somebody had just pulled out of their cold storage. they're organic, but or some, in some cases not, but you know, they travel 15 miles.
And what that translates into for all of us is lifestyle changes and choice changes. Do we need that kiwi in February? You know, do we need asparagus and strawberries? You can buy strawberries. And if you're buying it out of season, there's a pretty good chance that they had to use a lot more artificial inputs to get it to you out of season. Soft fruits especially, notorious for all the inputs.
And I think a big question for Holden is, do we really need bananas?
Very good question.
Yeah, tomatoes.
Very good question. Yeah.
Very good question. The other thing, a health issue for Ed. Banana boxes are fumigated. The box, the fibers of the box are infused with fumigants.
Well, what about if they get organic bananas?
Well, if you get organic bananas, that's not the case.
Well, you don't. Okay.
It's a health issue for the garbologist. And you see people moving their stuff down lake in banana boxes because they're, you know, I've seen that a number of times. It's a nice sturdy box with a top and a bottom, and it's infused with fumigants. That's how they make the box.
You don't want those trash.
Because they're shipped all the way from Central America over the course of a couple weeks, and a lot could happen. So they've got to have some type of an insecticide all the way to the point of purchase.
Well, and then, you know, that is, as you think about that and insecticides in other countries, and you always need to think about the farm laborers too. Mm-hmm. And when you are buying organic or buying local, you've got a little more control over that. And that's why I said you're very powerful, and I've just found that out myself, not as an organic farmer, but just as a consumer. And I will say consumer now because it's not just things that you eat, but anything that you buy. And I've started to really take that seriously, and it's a big responsibility as part of my parenting and part of my homemaking and all of that. It's, you know, always think before you buy it, because we're a consumer-driven culture. Hey, you're playing a big role in it. I mean, that's why General Mills is marketing organic. It's not because they have a philosophy about it. It's you said that you're going to prefer this, and you know, hopefully. But if you can stay local and organic, then you're also pulling the philosophy too. So.
How are we doing on time here? I don't want to. Okay. 20. What? A couple more closing thoughts or questions, and we're going to have a couple more forums over the next couple minutes.
I do want to say, as we're sitting with you, we know we're preaching to the choir. And we think that it's just incredible that Holden has a food policy that involves local and organic and a connection with the farmer. You know, you could say, we're up here in the mountains, we can't help it, we got to do what's easiest, we got to feed all these people, blah, blah, blah. But you haven't done that. You
it's
have
been
taken
a priority, yeah.
You have taken that. And Grant was saying, I saw you here at our Harvest Festival. This is so great. You come up here, they roll out the red carpet, they treat you like a king. You need that.
I just wanted to say something. One of the things that we've been talking about is, today in fact, is transporting resources from Holden Village to the wider Holden community. And Tom Witt has been working on kind of revamping the website and putting stuff on about what's Holden talking about or doing at this point. I think that this information you have here with maybe some links, maybe some advocacy would be a great thing for us to send tomorrow. And I'd be happy to work with them.
Yeah, and I said at the operation meeting today that Margaret and I would love to become more involved with your work with the resource room, with providing current relevant information that could provide people some of that link and things to change and do in their lives.
We have some resources here, and some of them are in the bookstore. But
it's a great book to read here, EcoFoods. EcoFoods. You can borrow. You can borrow our copy. There's not one in the library. There probably should be here.
This is sort of a fun story. We got this book because one of our members had come out to Holden this summer, bought the book in the bookstore, so brought it back and said, "You guys got to get this book. It's a great resource."
It's a very good overview of many of these issues that we were talking about, written in a very, very readable form. It doesn't beat you over the head and gives you lots of positive things you can do. So this would be one thing I'd recommend.
Lucia, has anyone read Small Wonders?
Yeah, that's
one of the fascinating essays in it about
food production.
There's two
right.
really good
ethics.
One on GMOs. One's on GMOs and one's on her own personal
right.
philosophy, of buying locally and growing your own food.
Well, and I have an article too with brought with me, just a short article somebody sent it to us from, they saw it on the internet. And it's about, I think, joining the CSA, buying locally. Maybe it's even part of that essay. And then I know there was something else she wrote about, and I would need to go back and read it. But it's a river in maybe New Mexico, and migratory. Yeah, she lives between there and Kentucky, so those are the two landscapes. But in this Farming the Wild, Dan, you want to show them that one?
Yeah.
This is also really a positive thing that's part of this whole solution stuff. It's a group of it's an organization called Wild Farm Alliance. And they're a group of folks that came together saying, you know, we've got this environmentalist versus farmer thing going on, and the land is so important to all of us. How do we all work together? And it's just example after example of people working with nature and with their land and their landscape instead of against it. And how they get rewarded by doing that. You know, the rivers become clean and grass starts growing where it didn't before and all kinds of things. And it's all over the United States and maybe some foreign countries, but mainly the United States. And we're going to leave this book here and donate to the library. But it's positive. You know, there's lots of great things happening out there right now.
We also brought the A to Z cookbook here, which we're going to donate to the kitchen staff, which is a guide to eating locally, seasonally. And the thing that I like about this cookbook in particular is it gives more recipes for those vegetables that you're not as familiar with. Instead of having tomato recipe, which we see all the time. And that's Madison. It's been updated, but yes, the Madison one. Yeah, Jen probably has a copy of this. So, Grant's going to be here for 6 weeks. We're going to be here for another week and a half. It's just been great being here. We're going to do a couple more sessions. We're going to try and take a look at this GMO piece a little bit more and what that means as a faith issue for us. And we're not a neutral party on this thing. So we really have some pretty strong feelings about it. And we'd love to have you be involved in that discussion. And we're going to do Vespers one night next week, talking about farming and some of our work on the land. And we're going to do a session on literature of the land, similar to Barbara Kingslover and Wendell Berry.
So start thinking of
like
stuff
that.
That you have that you'd like
and
to bring, because that's a
we want it to be a poetry reading and a essay sharing and, you know, people standing up and saying, you got to read this, and we're going to make a list and get it to Diane and Susie and see if we can make that a resource that'll reach more people. And then the other session that we're going to do is a sense of place. What does it mean for us to, what do we call home? Ed's going to lead that one with his moving back to his land in Kansas. And so anyway, thanks for coming, and we'll
and we really do appreciate folks asking us and talking to us whenever.
Thanks for all your questions and all your participation. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.